The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Welcome to The Trumpet Daily Show. I'm your host, Robert Morley. Stephen Flurry is up today, and he graciously asked me to fill in. You're listening to kpcg.fm online or 101.3 on the FM dial. I'd like to begin today's show by hitting some news headlines that I think a lot of people probably missed over this last couple of weeks. And I want to cover them because I think they give some pretty keen insight into the direction the United States is headed. This first article comes from Investors Business Daily, and it's dated April 26th. And the title of this article is Obama's Killer Economy. Obama's Killer Economy. And this article is pretty sad, but I think it highlights something that's very, very important. The article begins, middle-aged people laid off and unable to find work are taking another way out. They're killing themselves. Suicide rates are soaring, according to federal data released last week, especially in economically depressed states and job-starved regions like upstate New York. People in need of work are twice as likely to take their own lives as employed people, and people fired in their 40s and 50s find it hardest to get hired. The article continues, that makes boosting economic growth a life and death issue. But you wouldn't know it listening to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. President Obama whitewashes reality, claiming the, quote, American economy is pretty darn good right now. So what do you think? Is the economy pretty darn good, as President Obama says? What's your situation like? Well, you know, I think there's probably a lot of Americans who would disagree with the president on that one, that they aren't better off, that their children won't be better off than they are. I saw an article earlier on in the month that said 1 in 3 Americans had saved nothing for retirement. 1 in 3 working-age Americans had saved zero for retirement. And the article went on to talk about all the reasons. They talked about all the credit card debt that people are just buried under. They talked about student loan debt, automobile debt, mortgage debt, and how this was all this debt upon debt was just crushing people. And now we have a third of working age Americans that have nothing put away in their bank accounts. The article went on to say that there was another 23%, almost another quarter of those surveyed that had less than $10,000 put away. So they had somewhere between zero and $10,000. So you put that together, we're looking at 56% of working age Americans, more than half of Americans that have less than $10,000 saved away for retirement. I mean, these numbers are pretty tragic. They're terrible. They certainly don't paint a picture of a healthy economy or an economy that's pretty darn good right now. But thinking back to that article had another stat in it, and I thought that was probably even more important. And that article said that 28% of people aged 55 and above had nothing saved for retirement. So think about that for a minute. These are people 55 years and above. These are people that are nearing retirement. They don't have a whole lot of years left to ramp up the retirement savings. And a quarter of those people aged 55 and above said they had nothing saved for retirement. Now, what does that mean for our economy? What does that mean as it pertains to the state of finances in America? Well, these people are going to be wards of the state. I mean, these people have gone through their lives. They've been working for all these years or not working, whatever the case may be, and they've managed to get to this point where they have nothing saved up, and yet they're just a few years from retirement. These are people that are going to be dependents on the state. They're going to be people that rely on, you know, the generosity of others to take care of them. Not a good sign. Definitely not a good indicator of an economy that's working properly. Back to that Business Insider article. The article continues, the Obama economy is stalled. It grew at a measly 0.7% annualized rate in the first quarter of this year. That compares with a 3.5% rate that the United States enjoyed for most of the 20th century. So America's been growing at 3.5% for most of its history. And suddenly now we're growing at 0.7%. Now remember, this is 8 years after the Great Recession that struck in 2008. We're getting close to that 8 years. The article continues, true, the economy slowed under George W. Bush. Obama inherited a recession, and with it a suicide epidemic. When the recession hit, suicide deaths suddenly started outnumbering deaths from auto accidents. But 8 years later, job losses are still driving the suicide rate higher and higher. 8 years later, suicide rates are still rising. What is going on in America? Are things really getting better? Are they getting better? You know, this economy is supposedly recovered. We keep hearing that from the media. We keep hearing that from all the talking heads. But if that's the case, why have these suicide rates not changed directions? Why are they still getting higher and higher? The Business Insider article continues, Hillary Clinton seems not to care. She's pledging to close down the coal industry and block fracking of natural gas, which means more pain for coal country and for portions of upstate New York that are sitting on a natural gas treasure. Self-inflicted deaths in the Syracuse area are up about 40% in the last 5 years. 40%. And rates in depressed Western New York are double New York City's rate, all attributable to economic distress. Then the article says, upstate New Yorkers are literally dying for jobs. Upstate New Yorkers are literally dying for jobs. And it's the same across the country. The article says, similarly, joblessness is killing people in Walker County, Alabama, where the coal mines have been shutting down and leaving families destitute. Since 1999, premature deaths among the middle-aged there have more than doubled, some from suicide and others from slower methods of self-destruction like alcohol and opioids. In New Jersey, which used to have one of the lowest rates of suicide in the nation, it shot up 13% in 2 years. And then get this. It says stagnating wages are linked to suicide in every state. In every state. This is not something that's just happening in one or two states or a couple of states or just out in California or New York or someplace like that. It's linked to stagnating economy in every single state. And it goes on and it talks about Montana, you know, one of these more rural communities. It's up there just like the rest of the country. And then it says this, it says, economic distress is so widespread that for the first time ever, life expectancy of white women in the U.S. actually dropped. Life expectancy dropped for the first time ever. When you start hearing, you know, commentators and articles, analysis, talking about things happening for the first time ever, you know, we need to sit up and pay attention to that. The article says suicide kills more middle-agers than flu, pneumonia, and diabetes combined. I mean, this is a tragedy. Why haven't we been hearing about this? I haven't been hearing about this. Why isn't the media talking about this? I mean, if we're not talking about these sorts of things, how are we going to address them? How are we going to fix them? You know, it's like our media just wants to talk about easy things, talk about, you know, the happy things. But, you know, the reality is, if we want to fix things, if we want to improve things, we can't just hide them under the rug. And this article goes on and talks about, you know, the typical Republican solutions. You know, if we just did this, if we just cut taxes, yada, yada, all this, well, then, you know, the economy will surely get better. And the article asks, you know, why aren't the candidates putting forth their solutions? Well, you know, those candidates, they are starting to put forth their solutions. You just have to listen. And some of those solutions are probably just as worrying or even more worrying than the actual reality of what's happening out there, because they aren't going to solve their problems. But that really is, that really hits on the subject of today's Trumpet Daily. You know, what is the solution to America's economic problems? What is the solution? You know, is it simply just cutting taxes? Is it electing Donald Trump to president? You know, what is going to fix this problem? There are millions of Americans who are struggling with depression, who are struggling because of this poor economy. And it doesn't matter what politicians say about how good it is. The reality on the ground is that people are taking their lives because of it. And this is a trend that's getting worse and has gotten worse for every single year of the last 8 years. So this isn't something that we can pretend isn't happening, because it is. And it's affecting millions of people. I just want to, before we get into more of that, I want to read you just a couple of other quick headlines here, because it's important that you understand that we understand the true economic condition of America, because the situation is much worse than most people, I think, realize. Some of you probably heard that on April 13th, Peabody Energy filed for bankruptcy. Peabody Energy was the largest coal company in the United States' history. I mean, this was a company that survived the Great Depression and went through, you know, multiple stock market crashes, both world wars, the Wall Street meltdown in 2008. This Peabody Energy, this was a company that was founded by a man who started hauling coal in the back of a wagon, pulling it with a mule. And from that, in 1883, he took that company, helped, worked hard, built that company to finally in the 1940s, it was listed on the New York Stock Exchange and made it to the big time. At one point, this company had shares that were worth over $100 a piece. So this was really a rags to riches story of America. This is one of those true success stories, I think, that proved, you know, that showed people that anything is possible. You can be a migrant and come to America and make it. And make it big and make it to the big time. And you know, if you put in enough work, if you work hard enough, then you can succeed in the United States. You know, this was a company that really embodied that. In 2011, the company was valued at $20 billion. $20 billion. Now, 5 years later, less than 5 years later, those shares are worth pennies. You know, the company's bankrupt. You know, what happened? What happened to Peabody? What took it down? If you asked a company, that, you know, there's a lot of reasons. They cited, you know, things like an unprecedented turndown in the economy, a slowdown in China, the overproduction of shale gas. You know, some people, they blame the Environmental Protection Agencies. They said this was President Obama's war on coal, and I think there's some validity to that. Both of those, all those things listed are very real reasons. But, you know, there's something else that you can trace this company's demise to, and that is simply, and it was the factor that they didn't recognize and very few people recognize, and that factor is debt. Peabody, for everything that it had going for it, it was just burdened under piles and piles of debt. Had $10 billion worth of loans that were due this year and next year. And you know what? Every single one of its mining operations was profitable. It just couldn't make enough money from those operations to pay the interest and the principal on that debt. Now, this is something I think that Americans need to pay attention to, because Peabody Energy is not alone in this situation. I mean, this was a company that had been in existence for almost half of America's history, and it was taken down suddenly and dramatically by debt, by too much debt. And it really is a sad end to a company that in many ways helped build America. I think 10% of America's electricity was coming from this one company alone. And they have over 8,000 people who work for them. Many of them will be losing their jobs. In case you think that it's only the fossil fuel industry that's in trouble, I have one other headline for you here, and that is the world's biggest green energy company files for bankruptcy. This is SunEdison. You probably heard about this on April 21st. It was one of the largest bankruptcies by asset value involving, you know, a non-bank in a decade. So this is a huge bankruptcy. They had $12 billion worth of debt on their bank balance sheet. So here, once again, we have a company that was just burdened with debt. This is a company that we pumped millions, hundreds of millions, I think about over $600 million worth of taxpayer credit. So this isn't a company that, you know, had tax loopholes. This was a company that the government was writing checks to promote green energy. $650 million worth of taxpayer money we sent to that company. They had over 7,000 employees, and now those employees are all at risk of losing their jobs. That just happened on April 21st. So that's another one of these stories, I think, that didn't get enough play. One more just a quick news item here. This one is titled $15 minimum wage sends California businesses fleeing. This is by the Daily Caller on April 26. California businesses are already starting to move out of the state less than a month after lawmakers raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour, according to reports Monday. California beat New York by a couple of hours to become the first state to raise its minimum wage. You probably heard about this. Then this article says now businesses are already starting to leave the state in response to the upcoming increase. And this article just goes through and talks about the different businesses that have already announced, hey, we just can't do it. $15 an hour that raises our cost of labor too high. We're already on the edge of being unprofitable. So we basically have to pack up our bags and go. And it talks about, you know, this shift to automation that's going on. How all these entrance level type jobs are now being computerized in the fast food industry. We're going to see tellers where you go up and you push the button, stick your credit card in, and you make the order on the screen yourself. But here's what I got. Here's one of the things from this article that got me the most. This was the Jerry Brown, the governor of California, as he's getting ready to sign this law onto the books. He's holding a press conference. And he's getting ready to sign this. And this is what he says. He says, as he's about to sign this into law, into California law, he says, economically, minimum wages may not make sense. You get that? Economically, minimum wages may not make sense. But work is not just an economic equation. It's part of living in a moral economy. Are you kidding me? Here he is going to sign the law, and he's telling everybody that it doesn't make economic sense. Why doesn't it make economic sense? Well, he knows this is going to lead to job losses. He knows that it was going to lead to all these businesses exiting the state. But here he is. He's going to pass it anyway. Why is he going to pass it anyway? Well, here he's telling you, saying, well, it's moral. It's moral to pass this because, you know, it's part of living in a moral community. Well, what is he talking about? How is it moral that he's signing a law in supposedly to help people that's going to cause job losses? You know, how is it moral to be signing away people's jobs, saying, no, you're out of a job now because that job doesn't pay enough. That job doesn't earn enough money for that employer. So because of law, he can no longer pay you a salary at that rate, that I'm going to legislate that job out of existence. These are people whose lives are being impacted by laws like this. And all we hear from the media is, oh, how great these minimal wages are. Well, here's the governor saying, no, no, in reality, there's going to be some economic consequences of that. Actually, we built into this law that if it causes too many job losses, we're going to stop with the wage increase because we know they're going to happen. We know they're going to happen. And Brown said, morally and socially and politically, the minimum wage makes every sense because it binds a community together and it makes sure that parents can take care of their kids in a much more satisfactory way. Really? Is that going to help the parents who lost their jobs? And it's going to cause job losses. Guess what? Guess who's lobbying to be exempted from this law? Yeah, one of the biggest organizations behind this push. One of the biggest unions in California that was lobbying for this law. Now they're lobbying to be exempt from this law. Why do you think they're doing that? You think maybe it's because they realize that it's going to cause job losses? Yeah, they said, yeah, we want to be exempt from this because we want to be able to negotiate with employers other non-financial benefits. We want to, you know, things like maternity leave and other forms of retirement benefits and things like that. Well, really, is that the motivation? Or do you think maybe the motivation is, well, if your union members can work for employers and not get paid the minimum wage and maybe get paid $12 an hour, who's the employers going to hire? The guy that they have to pay 15 to or 12? Maybe there's a little self-interest for the union employees going on here. And what about that union? You think they really have what's at best for their employees, their members? Or is it more about enriching and empowering those unions? Just crazy what we see going on out in California. A lot of forces at work going on out there. Really reminds me of the Affordable Care Act we heard so much about in the lead up to that, and how Congress passed this law that's supposedly supposed to be so good for the rest of this country, and then they go ahead and exempt themselves from it. It's good for everybody else, but not for us. You guys have to do with it. Do what we say, but we're not going to do what we say. Yep. So there you have it. Unions out in California pushing for the minimum wage up to $15, and then they want to be exempted from it behind doors, closed deal, and very few people hear about that. But, you know, our economic problems here in America are not being solved. They aren't being solved. We have a lot of issues, and we're going to talk about some of those issues on today's program. It's getting close to a time for a quick break here. But before I let you go, I just thought I'd mention a lot of these types of news items that I've been reading here today. These headlines are covered in our Philadelphia Trumpet News magazine. This is a magazine that covers current events. It hits topics like the economy or science or geopolitics, our society type issues. And I think the writers just do a fantastic job. I'm one of them, so I'll give myself a little pat in the back there. I think they do a great job of bringing the important news and intelligence to our readers. And the best part about this is that it's absolutely free. There's no cost or obligation associated with this magazine. So if you want to sign up, just go ahead and log on to the trumpet.com website and submit an application, and you can start receiving that magazine, this high quality magazine, in your mailbox. There's about 300,000 other subscribers who get that magazine every month. So go ahead and log on to the trumpet.com and get your free subscription. Time for a quick break here. But when we come back, I'd like to talk about the tragedy that is happening in a part of the United States. And this is a tragedy that is totally avoidable, but it's impacting millions of people. And most importantly, this is something I think foreshadows a trend that's going to take place in the rest of the country very, very soon. We'll be back in a moment.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Can you imagine a world without famine, disease, and pestilence? A world free of crime, war, and hatred? Man has tried throughout history to rid the world of these problems, but to no avail. Will man ever find the way to peace? The Bible speaks of a soon coming utopia in which God will finally bring us peace. It will be a world governed by God's law of love. Poverty, famine, illiteracy, and escalating violence will be reversed. The dry and barren lands of the world will be made fertile, and resources will be plenteous. Sickness and disease will be replaced by robust and prosperous living. The language barrier will be bridged, and an education in the true values of life will flourish the world over. Beyond this bleak, unhappy, present-day reality is this soon-coming future. Our booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, is free at our website, thetrumpet.com. Download it or request it free today.
The Trumpet Daily.
Hi, and welcome back to The Trumpet Daily. I'm your host, Robert Morley. Stephen Fleury is out today, and he asked me to fill in for him. You're listening via KPCG.FM or 101.3 on the FM dial. We've been talking about economic news in America, the looming debt crisis, how some of America's biggest companies have recently gone bankrupt, and how some of these problems that result from government intervention. We've been talking about the $15 minimum wage laws that are now law in California and New York. But now I'd like to talk about something else that is going on that I think that really is a huge warning for America. Today, the big news hitting financial markets is about Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, as you may have heard, has defaulted on its debt. It has refused or unable, depending on your perspective there, to make a $420 million debt payment. The governor of the island basically said that it was either paying this debt payment or it was keeping the lights on at the schools and the government-run hospitals, and he chose to protect his people. And in one sense, I really applaud the governor. I mean, those bond investors who lent money to the island, they did that knowing full well the risks of lending to a country, or not a country, a territory that was so burdened by debt and who had been warning that it was having, it was very obvious to all that it had some very, very big financial problems. I mean, that's why those lenders got that higher rate of interest, because those Puerto Rico bonds were distressed debt. They paid that higher rate to compensate, supposedly compensate investors. The sad thing, though, one of the sad things is I think that many elderly Americans probably have Puerto Rico bonds in their pension funds, and they don't even know about it. So there's going to be a lot of losers on both sides of the Caribbean there. I think there's around 20% of all mutual funds in the United States have Puerto Rico bonds within those mutual funds. So this is going to impact a lot of people. And this is one of those, you know, sad situations where a lot of mistakes were made. They were made years ago, and they hadn't been corrected, and politicians were unable or unwilling to correct it, and there really are just no good solutions. So it really is sad what's happening to Puerto Rico today. But people need to pay attention to what's happening down there. I think Americans, sometimes we tend to ignore what's going on down in Puerto Rico. It's far away. It's a small island. But I think it really does have a lesson for America as a whole. And we do need to be paying attention to that island. Puerto Rico, for our international audience, those of you who might be a little unfamiliar with it, it's a U.S. island. It's an island territory located in the Caribbean. It has a population of 3.5 odd million people. If you've never gone there, if you don't know much about it, the people who live there, they're all American citizens, so they have U.S. passports. English is the language. And this is an island that really used to be just a tropical paradise. Well, I mean, in many ways, it still is a tropical paradise. You know, the climate still, the beautiful climate, and in terms of landscape, etc. It is has beautiful beaches, as that tropical rainforest. It has dry forests. It has a lot of things really going for this island. I think there's the largest rum distillery in the world is in Puerto Rico. It's Bacardi. It was established there back in the 1950s. Yet something is very, very wrong with Puerto Rico today. Here's what the Independent paper said. They had an article titled "Puerto Rico, Island of Lost Dreams. People are leaving the debt-hit territory in droves." The Island of Lost Dreams. This is the Independent talking about Puerto Rico. The article begins, "The posh boutiques that once lined cobbled Calle Fortaleza are now gone, replaced by t-shirt and souvenir shops grasping for dollars from passengers swarming down the gangways of ships that dock here. Bars advertise happy hours lasting from noon till night, while old men pushing tatty ice cream carts go mostly unnoticed. Old San Juan, the colonial gem of Puerto Rico's capital, San Juan, is tired but clinging on. Elsewhere on the island, the story is graver. Exhausted by a recession that has lasted for most of the past 8 years, and by talk of a possible default on government debt that happened today, Puerto Ricans are leaving in droves. Many who stay are jobless. Doctors who haven't been paid in months are downing their stethoscopes. The pain that is Puerto Rico's, and could soon be Wall Street's if a debt crisis isn't resolved, is poignant." Well, the pain has come to Wall Street now. The pain has come to America. So here is this island that for all intents and purposes, should be the richest island in the Caribbean. And instead, it's bankrupt. I mean, this island has the biggest rum distillery in the world. It had an oil refining business on the island. It has, you know, fantastic tourism possibilities, free access to the largest economic market in the world. And everybody there speaks English. I mean, this, of all the islands in the Caribbean, this was an island that had practically everything going for it. Of all Caribbean islands, it should have been the most wealthy. But here today, we're finding out it's bankrupt. They just missed this massive debt payment. And conditions are getting worse and worse on this island. So what is going on in Puerto Rico? What happened to this island? Well, that article titled "The Island of Lost Dreams" goes on. It says, "This island has lost 20% of its jobs since 2006. The unemployment rate stands at over 13% since that article was written. It's actually 15% today. The article says, no wonder people want to get out. Then it quotes this person. It said, This person says, people who graduate from the university go straight to the airport and never come back. And that's Christopher Torres. He's a 25-year-old student who's studying computer engineering at the University of Puerto Rico. He said, and the article continues, some 144,000 Puerto Ricans decamped for the U.S. last year. 144,000 got on airplanes and boats and got off the island. They go straight to the airport and they never come back. And the numbers seem like they're holding up again this year. A White House official privately described what's happening as, quote, the biggest population displacement ever seen outside of war. The biggest population displacement ever seen outside of war. That's the White House. Did you hear about that? The biggest population displacement. Other articles talk about the quote-unquote mass exodus that's happening in Puerto Rico. You know, there's more Puerto Ricans living in the United States now that were born in Puerto Rico than there are Puerto Ricans living in Puerto Rico. This independent article continues. And now it's starting to get to the cause from some of this. It says the debt hole is worse than anyone is admitting. Beyond what it owes to bond investors, the government is also facing a $34 billion gap in money that should have been paid to the public workers' pension system. If you add that all up, it comes out to more than $100,000 in debt for every working person on the island. And we know the government massages its employment statistic number. So that number is actually a lot higher than that. And I'm just going to read you a little bit more about what's going on this island, because this is a U.S. territory. These are Americans that are living in this situation. And they are going through just horrendous problems. And the point for the rest of us is let's not think that we're immune to this. I mean, this happened to a U.S. territory. And the same sort of factors that have caused this to Puerto Rico are now moving to mainland America. The article talks about doctors and the government-run healthcare system falling apart. There's no money for them. There was, I think they said in 2014, there were over 360 doctors that left this tiny island, about one a day. Then 2015, it was above 500 doctors that left. They say there's only two neurosurgeons left on the island, and one of them is 90 years old. I mean, that guy is not working, doing any surgery. I wouldn't have neurosurgery anyway, but a 90-year-old neurosurgeon trying to help people because there's nobody left on the island. This article interviews people who, you know, yeah, this one lady is talking. She's like, yeah, my dad used to have a high-paying job working for the government electrical company, and now he's out of work, and we have nothing, and we're poor. And this girl goes on to say, look, I'm just trying to get through college here, and then I'm getting out. We have PhDs in this island working at Walmart. We're leaving. And she's like, I have friends in major cities all over America. And as soon as I graduate, I'm going to Dallas. And other people are like, I'm going to Houston. I'm going to this place in the United States. We're just getting out. And the article goes on, and I have several articles here, a Bloomberg article on the same topic. Others, they talk about just how the island is starting to break down. The basic social services that all Americans are used to, trash service, you know, healthcare services, they're breaking down. Utilities, they're all falling apart because the government has no money. There's no money left. The money is gone. It's all been spent. And now law and order is starting to break down too. The police are corrupt. The underground economy is growing. And you know what the solution is, according to the politicians? Tax people more. We need to tax more. So they embarked on a massive taxing binge. And now Puerto Rico is the second highest tax nation in all the Caribbean. They can't push tax rates any higher because every time they do, less money comes in. So it's self-defeating. And we have this beautiful, beautiful island that is just breaking down. But here's the point. Puerto Rico really was the poster child of socialism. For all those people in America that long for more of a socialistic society, that was Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico was a little Cuba inside the United States. I mean, they had the government-run institutions. They had the massive welfare type institutions. That was Puerto Rico. I mean, they have two parties in Puerto Rico like we do on the mainland United States. But instead of having Republicans and Democrats, they have like far left socialists and the more far left socialists. So, I mean, they have even less of us. But look at what has happened to that island. And it really is just a warning for America, this beautiful, prosperous island that uses the U.S. dollar, our currency, is just falling apart. And it really is a warning for America. This is what happens the further away you get from God. The further away you get from God. Now, I know some of you might be thinking, how dare he bring God into the equation? What happened to Puerto Rico? God's involved with that? I mean, I could see where some people would think that might be somewhat of an inflammatory statement, you know, that God has something to do with Puerto Rico's condition. But hang with me here. I just want to just give me a moment and we'll get to that. And I'll make my case that what is happening in Puerto Rico, what is happening in America today is related to God. It is related to God. Okay, I have a quick video clip that I'd like to play at this point. Now, this is a video clip or an audio clip, excuse me, from Fox News. So let's just go ahead and play this now.
Hey everybody, I'm Dan Joseph with MRC TV. Today I'm at the University of Colorado in Boulder at the site of the third GOP presidential debate. Now, the University of Colorado, very, very liberal college campus. There are Bernie Sanders supporters everywhere. Now, Bernie Sanders is a socialist, and today I'm going to ask some of his supporters what exactly that word means and whether or not they think Bernie Sanders could potentially win a general election. You're big Bernie Sanders supporters, aren't you guys?
I am.
What do you like the most about Bernie Sanders?
Well, so for one, college tuition is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for it to be like $30,000 a year.
It means that there's more support for social programs. So we actually put money and invest in things like Social Security, paid medical leave for the middle class, things like that.
Doesn't President Obama support those things, though?
Yes.
Why do you like Bernie Sanders so much?
He's the bomb. Like, what's not to like?
He's everything. The bomb. You did it for me. I'm officially a Bernie Sanders
honestly,
supporter.
Free college tuition. Like, who doesn't want that?
You're a Bernie Sanders fan.
I am a Bernie Sanders fan.
What do you like about Bernie?
I like socialism.
What do you know about socialism? What do you think that word means? He calls himself a socialist.
I'm a socialist.
Okay, what do you mean by socialist?
I love socialism.
What is socialism?
Socialism, oh, that's a tough one.
Democratic socialism to me means that we want a government that is making sure that our economy is working for everybody and our government is working for everybody. We have a lot of income inequality in this country.
He wants to spread the wealth between all citizens. I'd say the single-payer healthcare system is one of them.
What exactly is a democratic socialist?
So I think what he means by that phrase is he thinks that income inequality is unfair and that we need to apply regulations and stuff to limit the amount of wealth that people can accumulate.
We want the government not to say, this is a free market doing whatever the hell it wants to do, but we want to take action here and actually do something to make this different.
What do you think he means when he says I'm a democratic socialist as opposed to a Democrat?
Equality among people, equality among the different social classes.
Okay, because Barack Obama talks about that all the time. Does that make him a socialist? President Obama has supported doing all of those things
yes.
when he was running. Is President Obama a socialist as well?
I would say President Obama has socialist tendencies. I don't think you can be a socialist unless you declare yourself a socialist.
What's the difference between Bernie Sanders and Obama on that?
Obama is much more moderate.
You think so?
Yeah, he is actually fairly middle of the road.
So maybe if Barack Obama were a little more honest, he'd say, I'm socialist too.
Okay, so there you heard it. That was a clip from Fox News. So these are the young people. These are the next generation in America. And if you've been watching the lead up to this next election that's looming here, if anything, you've had to have caught on to this phenomenon which has been Bernie Sanders. And when it comes to young people, nobody is stirring up young people like Bernie Sanders is today. And if we would have kept listening to that clip, it goes on to make the points that President Obama himself is very much of a socialist president. But Bernie Sanders, in some way, I mean, this guy is even more radical. I mean, well, at least Bernie Sanders is open about it. President Obama, he'll say one thing and then do something else. He'll say one thing to reassure people and do something else. But Bernie Sanders, I mean, he is open about it. He is not ashamed of being a socialist at all. I mean, he's a proud socialist. And well, look, here's the point of this. One of the two front runners for the Democratic leadership is a man who is an outspoken, proud, unashamed socialist. I mean, and this guy is drawing massive crowds. Last year he filled a stadium of 28,000 people, and it was packed. And this is to come see, you know, somebody who's saying we need to make America socialist. As of March 21st, over 1.5 million people under the age of 30 had voted for Senator Sanders. And that's 1.5 million people. That's more than three times more youth votes than any other candidate has gotten in either party. More than three times more youth votes than Donald Trump, than Clinton, than Ted Cruz. I mean, this is something that's happening in America. Another entrance poll at the Iowa caucus found that Sanders had received 84% of the millennial generation vote. I mean, the young people, you heard it in the clip, the young people just love him. They love this idea of socialism. You know, and we're getting close to half of young people under 30, half of people under 30 that think socialism is the best thing. Majorities of young people, because there's, you know, always a demographic that's not sure. The majorities of young people in America today prefer socialism over capitalism. What is up with that? What is going on in America? Here's what trumpet writer Andrew Miller wrote about this. There's an article up on the trumpet.com right now, and it's an excellent article. It's titled, "Bernie Sanders' Revolution Has Already Been Won." And here's what he says. He says, "Whether or not Sanders receives the Democratic Party's nomination for president, the socialist ideology he espouses has taken root in the next generation of American voters. He says, unless something drastic changes, the future of the United States lays in the hands of a new silent majority that favors socialism over capitalism." Well, I'd add that it's a not-so-silent majority anymore. If you've seen any of these rallies, people are out there, and they are not ashamed to be socialist. I mean, there was a time in America when that was a dirty word. To be labeled a socialist was the end of your career politically. Not today. Not today. And sadly, I mean, the same types of policies that Bernie Sanders, that these socialists are pushing for, that they love, that they espouse, are the same policies that brought down Puerto Rico. I mean, America, whether it wants to admit it or not, is well on its way to becoming Puerto Rico. That's just what is happening. And this is a trend that is only going to speed up in America. We see it with the young people today, the young people, the future leaders of America. And sadly, so many of them, how many of these young people do you think really understand what socialism is about? When they started pushing those young people on that clip, you know, well, what is socialism? What is it? Well, all of a sudden it gets very vague. It's all these platitudes like, oh, it's about fairness. Well, who decides what fairness is? Oh, some government bureaucrat? Yeah, like once some socialist dictator decides what's fair, like the dictators in Cuba? Is that what America really wants? Is that what these young people are really, really asking for? Well, come on now. America really is changing very, very dramatically, and it is becoming a socialist country. Even without this Sanders phenomenon, you can just look at how America has changed over the last few years. It is definitely on its way to becoming Puerto Rico. Now, earlier I said that America's economic problems are the result of getting further away from God, right? I said that. Well, you know, this trend that we've been talking about has been in place, as I said, far before Bernie Sanders ever got on the national stage. Now, look, here's the thing. God's laws, as outlined in the Bible, bring prosperity. They bring prosperity. And when you get away from those laws, there's consequences to those laws. America's problems, economic problems, are the result of broken laws. Like America, you need to realize that God is not a socialist. God is not a socialist. And you know what? God isn't a communist. God isn't a Marxist. And you know what? He's not a capitalist either. All of man's systems today have aspects that are anti-God. All of them differ from the laws and the principles as outlined in the Bible. And the reason I'm picking on socialism today is because so many people in America, so many young people in particular, seem to think that socialism is the answer to America's problems. But socialism won't solve America's problems. It won't. Look what happened to Puerto Rico. Socialism is going to make America's problems worse. Now, I think a lot of people think that, you know, socialist type policies are supported by the Bible, and that the Bible has a lot of socialist principles, but that's simply not true. I think a lot of people look at the Bible's commands for charity, for giving to the poor, for, you know, taking care of the stranger or the foreigners in your land as evidence that God favors a socialist type government. And I think a lot of people look at it that way, but it's not true. If you know anything about the Bible, you know that the Bible talks about two ways of life. And this is something that Herbert W. Armstrong, who is the founder of the organization, the Philadelphia Church of God, the organization behind this radio station, he talked a lot about the two ways of life that the Bible talks about, the way of give and the way of get. And God's way is based on giving. Now, giving is something that is free will. And this is very important to understand. Giving is free will. Giving is voluntary. You know, just like the free market is voluntary. You know, voluntary giving is the exact opposite of socialism. Socialism is based on taking. You know, when you take other people's money or property to give to others, you know, that's not giving. That is not giving at all. You're taking from someone to give to others. You're taking from one, you know, disadvantaged group, one group to give to another group. But that isn't really giving. That's taking. And that's not God's way. That's not God's way of giving. That's not how God intended nations to function. Now, God commands giving. He does. God commands that you are to give as you are able. But the key is that you decide what you are able. And then God blesses or he curses based on individual obedience to how we are obeying the spirit of the law. Now, you know, God also commands tithing. You know, and here once again, never does God command that, you know, the churches go out and deduct people's paychecks, that they just take out, you know, the tithe, the 10% right off the top. God never commands that. It's always, always, always up to the individuals to tithe. It's always voluntary. And God knows, you know, who his people are based on their obedience to his laws, how they are giving, how well they are adhering to God's commands, his laws. And then God blesses accordingly. But God's way is always based on free will. It's based on bringing true freedom to people. Now, there's law. Sure, there's law. But the only way you have true freedom is with law. And if you have your Bibles with you, we have a few minutes left here at the end of the program. Go ahead and turn to 1 Samuel 8. Here's some really, really interesting history. Now, this is a history of when Israel first chose their king, their very first king. Now, up to this point in the nation's history, God was their king. Okay, let's begin reading here in verse 1. It says, 1 Samuel 8, verse 1, "And it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel." Verse 3, "And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre and took bribes and perverted judgment." So here's this legitimate problem with how the system was functioning in Israel. There were problems with how the system was being administered, not with the system itself. Now, the problem wasn't with the law itself or the form of government itself. The system wasn't wrong, but how it was functioning, how those laws were not being enforced was the problem. So here's this problem. Verse 4, "Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came unto Samuel, unto Ramah, and said unto him, Behold, you are old, and your sons walk not according to your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the other nations." Make us a king to judge us like every other nation out there. We want to be just like all the other nations. Continuing on, "But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, Give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Eternal, and the Eternal said unto Samuel, Hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them." So here we see, you know, Israel, it wanted to be just like all the other nations around them. And like ancient Israel, the United States today really has a unique history. The United States really is unique from all other nations around this world, especially when it comes to things like property rights, economic freedom, the rule of law. I mean, the United States stands out like a beacon in this world in terms of how unique it is. And yet now we have a situation where in the United States, so many of its people, so many of its young people in particular, they just want to be like all the other nations. They want to be like all the other nations around them. Now, the ancient Israelites, they didn't realize how good they had it. They really didn't. They didn't realize how free they were. They didn't realize how special they were. And look what they got. You know, God tells Samuel, okay, give them their king, but warn them what it will be like. Verse 11, and he said unto them, he said, this will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. And you can read the next few verses, and it talks about how the king will take from you to give to his servants, how he'll take from you to give to his friends. He'll take a tenth of this from you and give to his people. I mean, it's a perfect description of our economies today. It's a perfect description of our societies today. And suddenly Israel found out that it was no longer free. It was no longer free. And as it says in verse 18, and you shall cry out in that day because your king, which you have chosen you, and the eternal will not hear you in that day. Today, Puerto Ricans are crying out. They're fleeing to America where there's still more freedom. But that's not going to be enough. That isn't going to help them for the long run. As God says in verse 18, he won't hear their cry because people are disobeying him. So socialism is coming to America. What we're seeing happening in Puerto Rico is coming to America. And that story of Puerto Rico, that beautiful island that should be so prosperous, that has everything going for it, really is a warning for the rest of us. How far are we behind Puerto Rico? A year? A 2 years? You know, and sadly, this is a warning that's going unheeded. Well, you're listening to Trumpet Radio. Thank you very much for joining us today on the Trumpet Daily. Thanks to Stephen Fleury for inviting me on the program. Thank you for our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondeau, Josh Sloan, and all the other people who are working tirelessly behind the scenes. Please tune in tomorrow, same time, same place, 101.3 on the FM dial or kpcg.fm online and at thetrumpet.com. Looking forward to talking to you again.